Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For 15 years, Mark Bushnell has been writing columns for Vermont newspapers and websites about Vermont history. They're lovely columns, peeking into some dark corners, some rarely exposed areas of the state's past, and bringing them to life for us modern-day Vermonters. These days, his column, Then Again, is written for VT Digger. Bushnell explores stories that are footnotes to larger historical changes in Vermont, but they show us how rich our history is and the cast of sometimes inspiring, sometimes eccentric people who helped forge it. And now he's collected his pieces into a new book called Hidden History of Vermont. The book officially comes out November 13th. Mark Bushnell, what a pleasure to have you with us today.
Oh, thanks, Jane. I'm happy to be here.
I love the idea that you have, that the way you you place your book and you say right in the introduction, this is a travel book, and just not the kind of travel that people might expect when they think of a travel book. You're talking about time travel. Can you describe how you envision that people are seeing and reading this book?
Yeah, I'm really trying to make it like one of those off the beaten path travel books, you know, not taking you to the regular sites necessarily, or if you go to a place you've been before, maybe showing you another side of it. And I want it to be like travel books, and at least the way I read travel books. You don't necessarily read it cover to cover. You just sort of dip in and see what's interesting. And that's sort of where that idea came from me. And plus, you know, time travel would be pretty cool, and this is it's a lot cheaper than buying a time travel machine.
You know, the best part of that moment for me in reading it was when you talk about going to the Coolidge Estate and down in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, and you drive in and you say, I just feel like I might have even been able to see Coolidge if I had just driven a little bit faster. I mean, you do have that sense when you go there that it is a place lost in time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's most exciting about history for me is really visualizing sort of the waves of change that have come and how they're not necessarily that long ago. I mean, I remember reading something that John and Abigail Adams' granddaughter, who had known John Adams, died, I think, like a year before my grandfather was born. I mean, and it's just like it's not that many generations back, especially in the United States.
Yeah. These stories, these columns, these peeks into history that you've written, is there any common theme beyond a Vermont connection?
Probably not. I mean, I think the main theme is these are things that caught my interest. I mean, what I try to do is write about history and keep out the boring stuff. I mean, because not everything's interesting. I mean, I worked for years at newspapers, and I love the adrenaline rush of trying to hit deadline. But you really have to write about just, you know, your beat that you're on and what's new today. So you've really got these sort of narrow guardrails. And then occasionally at the newspaper, and then after I left and started freelancing, I started writing about history of Vermont, which is basically anything that I feel like is old enough to be history. I mean, my son would argue that that's like 15 or 20 years or something like that. But for me, it's like maybe I'm going to say 50 years or something.
Is there any particular story that you now look at as the one that started you off or that really gave you the bug to do this?
While I was still on the staff of the Sunday Rutland Herald and Times Argus, I got a chance to write, I think it was for the 75th anniversary of the Spanish influenza in Vermont. And my editor, Dirk Van Susteren, gave me, you know, I was sort of doing it on my own time, but he gave me like weeks to put this together. And I was able to read about the just the incredible impact that it had on the state. I mean, close to 2,000 people died in Vermont, which is just a staggering number. I mean, and anyway, I was able to – this was back before the internet, so I was reading lots of microfilm and actually had a good suggestion to go up and track down some people who'd survived. I went up to a nursing home right outside Barrie and talked to this guy who had remembered it, who'd lived through it as a child, and it just really brought it home. He talked – his name was Gifford Owen, and he remembered that his sister was the only one who'd remain healthy while – I mean, I think the state had something like, God, it was something like had something like 50,000 cases or something like that. And his sister remained healthy, and her reward was that she got to take care of the rest of the family. And he remembered, he was laid low for, he said he thought it was a couple of weeks. And when he finally got to get up and go outside, this was in the fall of 1918, he remembered seeing horse hooves in the dirt roads, and they'd made these little holes. And it had rained, and it was cold. He was going out in the morning, and these had left these little he described them as hundreds and hundreds of tiny mirror-like holes in the road. And he remembered breaking them. He said that was such a delight. He said walking outside for the first time in weeks, it felt like he had come back from the grave. And it was just great to be able to talk to that guy. And that story, I was sort of hooked on, wanted to do those. And when you're at a newspaper, you only can really do them when they're about an anniversary.
Uh-huh.
That's just the way the news works. But if you've got a weekly column, you got a built-in excuse to write about anything you want.
And the epicenter of that flu was Middlebury College. Is that right? That started at Middlebury?
I don't think they really know where it started. I do know that the first newspaper reports were about students at Middlebury and Norwich. Hmm. So, I mean, that would make sense that maybe they might have been out-of-state students who brought it in. I'm not really sure.
Hmm. When you think about your column now, I mean, you say if you have a weekly column, you have a built-in excuse. You also still then have a built-in deadline, and you have to be thinking all the time, not just about what the anniversary is, but, you know, how to populate this column over and over and over. So do you just have ideas, little scraps of ideas that are stored somewhere in either a digital or a physical filing system, or are you always scrambling to come up with a new topic?
Yeah, I mean, the physical filing system is my brain.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really bad about record keeping. Luckily, there's just so much out there. I don't know that you would ever run out of stuff to write about. I mean, I think first started out, I was a little strange way of doing this. I would walk around the library at the Vermont Historical Society and just pull books off the shelf to see what was interesting. And maybe the librarians took pity on me. Paul and Marjorie at the over at the library in Barrie are just wonderful, and they just have these incredible memories. And you just in conversation, I don't know if they're really pitching story ideas, but they're just talking about stuff, and it's just generated so many great stories out of that. And also they're great books like Freedom and Unity, which is this almost 800-page book of, you know, basically covers Vermont from, you know, the Ice Age up to about the year 2000. And that's been a great book because they had a lot of ground to cover. So they, you know, wrote from a 30,000-foot perspective, and they would have these little like clauses at the end of a sentence, and it'd be like, wow, that's interesting. But they had to keep moving. They weren't able to write more. And I was able to go back and see what it was that they were referring to.
Mark, let's, since we're in November now officially, let's talk about one of the stories that you have that feels particularly timely for November and this time of year, and talk a little bit about the turkey drives to Boston. Now, we've talked about this on the show before, but I never get tired of hearing about them. Can you describe them?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a good example of just how different things were once. I mean, it back in the early 1800s, they didn't have refrigerated train cars to ship birds to markets, so they walked them to markets. And when I'm saying markets, it's like mostly Boston. So they farmers who, you know, didn't have a large market to sell to in Vermont would get these herds of
but they had like, to herd them. So
they had to herd
of,
them,
yeah.
Of hundreds or even thousands of birds and start marching them to Boston. They would only make like 10 or 12 miles a day. So the trip could take 3 weeks. They had to come up with all of these elaborate systems. They would have, and because they were dealing with birds that aren't naturally herd animals, obviously. The lead bird would have a bell around its neck because it seemed like the other ones would follow. And then they had all the, I sort of picture these workers sort of fanning around this unwieldy flock and looking out for predators, looking out for strays, looking out for farmers who might want to claim that the turkey that had walked onto his property was, you know, his by rights. They had drovers in the back to keep them moving. And they also had a wagon that they had to come that came behind them that would carry the workers' tents and their food. And, of course, they had to bring corn for the birds who were burning off tons of calories. I mean, and probably creating lots of dark meat. I mean, I'm sure it was pretty pretty tough birds by the time they got to Boston.
It sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the worst part was that they had to stop at nightfall. And, you know, in the fall, it comes pretty early. Sometimes they would carry lanterns to try to get a few minutes extra a day. But they even ran into trouble trying to cross covered bridges because bridges are dark there. And sometimes the birds would think, well, that's it. They just sort of stop and
roost.
Try to go to sleep. Exactly.
Yeah. I would love to see one of those. And it sounds like a great way to get your Thanksgiving turkey because, yeah, if the turkey comes on your property, just, you know, grab it while no one's looking. And
that's right. I mean, it's not like they're branded or
right.
anything. They don't have collars.
I want to talk about other animals, too, because you divide the book by chapters and sections, and one of the sections is about animals. And it's pretty clear from the book that you're trying to make a point here about how closely tied our history is, our settled history, to animals, to animal husbandry, but also to wild animals, and how much a part of our culture that is, too. And you write about things like the Great Wolf Hunt. You write about the catamount. You write about a domesticated sheep. What do you think this tells us about our relationship to animals that we may be just either taking for granted or sort of not noticing these days?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, I think that mostly in terms of, farms have really fallen by the wayside in Vermont. So I think a lot of people don't have regular interaction with domesticated animals except for their pets. And also, it's not nearly as wild as it was. I mean, you mentioned the Great Wolf Hunt, which was it's a bit folklorish when you hear the story, but it does sound like back in the early 1800s, there was an effort. I mean, this is in the town of Berlin to just eradicate the wolves because there had been an incident where a boy had apparently been menaced by a pack of wolves and they've never been back in that part of Vermont again. So, I mean, like the catamount, I mean, they're these wild animals that people who settle here and who are trying to raise animals and families don't feel really comfortable with having around.
Yeah, and you see some reflection in that today. I mean, a lot of the conversations even about coyotes, you know, the hatred of coyotes and the hatred that we have had historically for wolves and the fear of apex predators. I mean, it all does tie back, and you can still see some of that today.
Oh, absolutely.
What about catamounts? Are you a believer? Do you think they're back?
I don't know. I mean, you hear those stories occasionally, but I mean, if you talk to wildlife biologists, they just don't think there's enough open land, I think, to support a breeding population. I mean, it's possible that I think there was one found. I mean, there was like scat that was analyzed in the last 15 years or 20 mm-hmm. years. And I think they said that was a mountain lion, but they think that it was. They don't know how it got here.
Right. It could have been domesticated yeah. and somehow got here or roaming, but the breeding population is what we're sort of waiting for.
Yeah. And if it's okay to segue
yeah.
into
it. Yeah.
There was a huge catamount frenzy in the 1930s. And there was a Reverend William Ballou who was out with his Boy Scout troop in Chester. And he saw what he was sure were mountain lion tracks because he'd spent time in Wyoming and he knew what those things looked like. And he came down and they even actually took a print of one of the paw prints. I mean, they took a cast of it. And he came down and announced what they had found. And they were met by a lot of derision because the last catamount was pretty much understood to have been killed in the 1880s. I mean, there was the Bennington Banner even said that, you know, the most astonishing part of this whole affair is that this graph seems to be worked by the clergy. And I think Ballou was really hurt by this. And there were some newspapers, to be fair, who sided with him. The Rutland Herald, I don't know which side they were on, but they offered $100 for a catamount alive or dead. I don't know how you bring one in alive, but anyway, Ballou organized this meeting of believers, which was sort of like a cross between a church supper and a UFO convention. and they organized this group with the greatest name. It's the Irrepressible and Uncompromising Order of Pantherites. it's probably too long a name for a band, but if there are any novelists out there, I think that would be a great name for a book.
It's pretty awesome. That's one of the things I love about your writing is that you have these details that you drop in and a wry way of writing about them. And I promise I won't talk only about your animal stories, but the column about the woolly mammoth, too, where you talk about how not only were the fossilized remains of a woolly mammoth found in Vermont, and that this was, somewhat big news, but you also include the detail that newspapers treated the discovery at the time as kind of interesting, but as just one more quirky thing that might have happened in Vermont's past. And you're trying to draw out here that it was more than that. This really taught us something about our early civilizations in this part of the world that we didn't know about before.
Oh, yeah. And I think a lot of people are still astonished by it, even though this is 150 years ago that the mammoth was discovered. I mean, it's all about – I mean, if you look at the record, it seems that there were woolly mammoths and all sorts of sort of animals you associate with the tundra, because that's essentially what was here after the glaciers receded. You know, and if you talk to archaeologists, they kind of think that people very well may have overlapped with mammoths, which is totally not how – I would have pictured early Vermont. Well, and you were mentioning that how newspapers were saying, oh, well, this is just one of those wacky things that's happening. Just a total weird quirk of history. The same year that the mammoth is discovered is the year that Phineas Gage, who's a railroad worker, has this terrible accident happen to him, and I think it's like a meter long. A metal rod is shot through his head and he survives.
Yeah, he was a railroad worker, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. And it taught people because his personality changed, and doctors figured out a lot about how different parts of the brain relate to personality, and that the brain, you know, it let them understand a lot more about brain science. But anyway, it was just – that was one of the other quirky things that was happening in the 1840s.
And of course, Phineas Gage did become a band name here in Vermont. So there you go.
Oh,
Mark.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Let's go to Alec, who's calling in from Randolph Center. Hi, Alec. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
A quick thank you to Mark. I've been doing historical research, and his articles have come up quite often. My question is about Vermonters. And of course, if we talk about Vermonters, we can talk about the original Vermonters, the indigenous people. We can talk about the people who claim six generations and then more recent arrivals. But I've been looking at the 1700s and 1800s, and I'm just interested in whether you've seen, we usually think of those Vermonters, those settlement Vermonters, as kind of homogeneous. And I wonder if you have seen differences between, let's say, Vermonters from the west side of the state and Vermonters from the east side of the state based on historical settlement.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there definitely are differences. I mean, the original settlers in the original, when I say settlers, I'm talking the Eurocentric sort of point of view, the European settlers who came into the Bennington area, and they were a quite religious group. You know, much more they don't really fit the image that you have when you think of early Vermonters if you're thinking of Ethan Allen, who was a deist and you know, had strong conflicts with would have had strong conflicts religiously with these early settlers in the Bennington area. But, I mean, traditionally there was a real schism between east and west sides of the state, and that was mostly political it had to do with where they got their deeds to their land, because
from
oddly,
New Hampshire or New York.
Exactly. And the weird thing is that the ones on the west side of Vermont got them from New Hampshire, and the ones in on the east side tended to get them from New York. And I think the reason is because both colonies were pushing to say this is the edge of where we're allowed to settle people.
So what were the differences that you see beyond religious differences?
I'm sorry, you were breaking up there.
What were the differences that you saw then? Go into a little more detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was mostly political, and I think that a lot of struggles between people has to do with their vested self-interest, and you know, coming back to what I was saying about property. I
mean, so basically, just who they hewed to politically, not so much that their cultures were different or their communities or their backgrounds.
Not that I've seen, but it's not an area of specialty for me.
Today, writer and historian Mark Bushnell is sharing stories with us from his new book, Hidden History of Vermont, stories he's learned and written about in his more than 15 years as a columnist in Vermont publications. You can read his Then Again column in VT Digger. Mark, you were noting a few minutes ago when you talked about settlers to Vermont, you were careful to note that you were talking about European settlers, white European settlers. In your writing and in your research, when you're looking at historical documents that, as you acknowledge, are by and large written by and then preserved by white men, how do you try to balance out the stories that you're telling so that they are inclusive of women and of people who are not white and of Native settlers?
Yeah, I made a real effort in the book to do that. And it is a challenge because they're not the ones telling the stories. I mean, I, for example, I wrote a chapter on the dilemma facing Abenaki in Vermont at the outbreak of the Revolutionary War, because they the Abenaki had sided with the French originally because they had because Champlain had made an alliance with them, and then the French lose, and so the Abenaki are stuck with the British. Starting in the 1760s, and then the revolution breaks out, and it's like, what's going on here? Because that's it. It's just British against British, and it's a little bit hard to understand why all these Europeans keep showing up and keep wanting to fight each other. There was an Abenaki woman. It's so rare to find quotes, historical quotes from Abenaki, and so I was really thrilled to find this one. At the outbreak of the revolution, she said, "Oh, strange Englishmen, kill one another. I think the world is coming to an end." I've tried to do that with I tell the story of Lemuel Haynes here, who was a preacher for, I think, about 30 years in West Rutland. But he was of mixed race, and he was very much accepted into the community because he was just apparently a brilliant speaker. And a very sharp wit. I really appreciated reading about him. There was some point when some little boys were sort of teasing him, and he was walking along the street, and they yelled, "Did you hear the good news? The devil is dead." And Haynes shakes his head and says, "Oh, you poor fatherless children! What will become of you?" And he was recognized. Middlebury College gave him an honorary master's. So he was some, you know. A black man born in 1753, you know, and goes on to get some recognition in the state. And I really wanted to include him in my book. And the same issue, I mean, shockingly enough, comes up about women. I mean, that's half the population. And it's the main way I've been able to write about them is through their efforts to get equal rights. And I've got a section about this group of women who, and sometimes their husband and men who also agreed with the cause, who came to Vermont in 1870 because they were lobbying Vermont to change its state constitution to allow women the vote. But if you look at it, I mean, Vermont at that time was considered to be sort of liberal in terms of women's rights because they could file divorce on the grounds of adultery, intolerable severity, or non-support. And a husband couldn't sell his wife's property without her permission. And that was about the extent of their rights, because once they were married, the men became legal guardians of their wife. I mean, the argument was that, you know, if women get into voting, it's going to debase women. And supporters said, well, you need women there because they're going to uplift politics. So it was this very strange debate. It ended up going to the Constitutional Convention. These famous women, sort of pre-suffragettes, came in. Julia Ward Howe, Lucy Stone, Mary Livermore, they were all famous in that realm in their day. And they barnstormed around the state, and they got – they got some terrible treatment in the newspapers. They were referred to as harpies and Amazons. At one meeting in Chittenden County, you know, they were just setting up to speak and someone threw hot peppers on the stove, which is sort of a primitive form of tear gas.
Yeah.
I mean, it just cleared the room out. And Julia Ward Howe had the courage to say, "Don't worry, at the next meeting, I got this. I'm going to go first. Even if they start throwing chairs, they will not throw me off because I read from my speeches." And I mean, I think it's really easy to think that, you know, if you look in the rearview mirror, that, well, these things were inevitable. But they really weren't inevitable at the time. I mean, there's no way that these people could have known that they would succeed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it took incredible courage. It ended up going to the state convention. And just as a sign of how this was hardly inevitable, the delegates at the state constitution, all of whom were male, voted 231 to 1. against granting the right to vote to women. And it was another 50 years, of course, before women got the vote.
When you talk about the treatment they got in the newspapers being called harpies and getting really, you know, terrible, terrible write-ups, were these write-ups by journalists? I mean, do you see change? You have looked at all of these old newspaper articles, you know, as far back as they go, whether you're doing it now on the internet or in the old days, you know, scrolling through on microfilm and microfiche. Do you see changes in journalism over the last 150 years?
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the editorial voice is in good newspapers has been removed.
Hmm.
I mean, it's very common in Europe that, you know, newspapers have a real perspective, but they're not supposed to here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a change that you see. I mean, you
oh,
saw,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it's always interesting to think about that because, you know, you mentioned changes and yet we start to see some of that coming back around these days in the news media and these ideas of who gets to make the news, who gets to say what the truth is and who gets to opine in the news depending on what their position is.
Yeah, and I might be biased as a former newspaper reporter, but I think I don't like newspaper being pushed in with television where I sort of think that and the internet. You know, blogs and things. I hope people don't confuse them. If you go to mainstream sources, they're really dedicated to getting the facts, you know, accurate and fair.
Yeah. You know, Mark, if people read your columns and read your books, I think they will have the idea of Vermont as a place that has often striven for independence and really valued its sort of frontier, rural, we can do it on our own character. And that's reinforced in your columns. And yet there are other ways that we think of ourselves that perhaps are more myth than reality. Do you have any particular stories that you think kind of debunk our idea of who we are as Vermonters or what Vermont is?
I don't know. I mean, I'm so steeped in these that it sort of creates, you know, my view of Vermont. I mean,
what's your view of Vermont?
It's complicated. I mean, I think, you know, we are an independent culture. You know, people are stubborn and they want to do things their own way, but we have a certain collectivism. I mean, we try to do things on a handshake still, I think, in a lot of places, and you still know your neighbors. It's not like, you know, everyone's on their 40 acres and leave me alone.
Mm-hmm. Will you tell us the story of Lucy Cook? I know there are chapters that you have on social activism. You have chapters on change, but you also have quirky characters, and she's one of them. And I really loved the story of her.
Oh, yeah. It's really odd. I mean, Lucy was Lucy Ainsworth, then Lucy Cook, was born in 1819 in Calais, outside Montpellier. It was a relatively poor family. She had 8 siblings. And then something strange happened to her. She got gravely ill and went into sort of a semi-conscious state. And from here, things get really weird because if you read the stories, there's so many contradicting versions of it, which I point out in my section on her. It's not clear if she was in this semi-unconscious state. It might have even been caused by her brother who had just come back from New York State who had been studying mesmerism, like being mesmerized, named after the guy who, you know, learned this hypnotism. And while she's in this state, she's gravely ill and she starts murmuring about a medicine, a concoction she wants her family members to make for her, none of whom are doctors. But she tells them to go and collect herbs and roots and make this for her. She drinks it and she quickly recovers, or in another version, gradually recovers. And she says that while she'd been semi-conscious, she'd heard a voice telling her this is what she needed to cure her. And at that point, she develops these supposedly mystical powers to cure people. Or in another version of the story, those powers didn't come on until she was 27 years old. But she began prescribing cures and while in a trance. And her husband would hypnotize her and then be sort of her scribe. She would say what the patient needed. and he would write it down and, you know, give some sort of prescription. That husband died, and she found another guy who was willing to serve that role. They moved to Boston, and they set up a private practice and shipped medicines all over the country. And they came up with such delectable-sounding cures as blood syrup, diuretic drops, diarrhea cordial, and lung syrup. So you can imagine they were bestsellers.
Yes. Thankfully, diarrhea cordial not really on the menu at many places anymore.
Yeah, maybe it's a trendy cocktail now.
Mark Bushnell, his new book is called Hidden History of Vermont. And really, there is something for everyone in this book. I mean, whether you're talking about the animal stories or the winds of change in Vermont and how they've shaped who we are, or, you know, the quirky stories of people who make cordials. It's all in Hidden History of Vermont. Its official publication date is November 13th. Mark, thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, my pleasure. It was fun.